Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon. It is I, Chuck Morse, here at Chuck Morse Speaks. Welcome to the program. As part of our ongoing history series, we're interviewing Robert T. Watson, Ph.D. He's published 3 dozen nonfiction books, 2 encyclopedia sets, 3 novels, and hundreds of scholarly journal articles, book chapters, and reference essays on topics in politics and history. Robert's recent books include The President's Wife, Affairs of the State, and America's First Crisis, which received the 2014 Gold Medal in History from the Independent Publishers Association. The book at hand this afternoon is The Nazi Titanic, the incredible untold story of a doomed ship in World War II. Robert, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure, Chuck. Thanks for having me on.
Robert, you've uncovered a really fascinating story here, a little-known chapter in the history of World War II. It deals with events that occurred right at the end of the war when the Nazis obviously were losing and knew they were losing, and his ship was scuttled deliberately, according to your research, containing prisoners. Talk about it, would you?
Yeah, it's a bizarre story. You know, we have, Chuck, this belief that we know all there is to know about history, when in fact there's more we don't know than we do know. Even for events as pivotal and momentous as the Second World War or the Holocaust, there's still lots of secrets out there, and this is one of them. The Nazis had a ship. The Germans had a ship called the Cap Arcona, and in the 1920s and 1930s, it was the most celebrated ocean liner afloat. American actors like Clark Gable, European monarchs, the world clamored to see the ship. It was built by the Germans to be the new Titanic. They even modeled it after the Titanic, and it looked like the Titanic, similar in opulence, size, fame, and although more technologically advanced. What happened, of course, during the Second World War was the ship is no longer this celebrated ocean liner. It was put under the use by the Nazis, and Hitler and Joseph Goebbels, his propagandist, and other top Nazis considered this to be the pride of the Third Reich. They loved this ship. They used it to make the world's most expensive propaganda movie. They printed stories about it, took photos of it. So in other words, they wanted to show to the world, look what we did. Your Titanic sunk, but look at our Titanic. So it was kind of known as the Nazi Titanic, if you will. And what happens at the end of the war is, as it's apparent that the Nazi empire is crumbling in the winter of 1945, right at the end, Hitler issues this infamous liquidation decree. He wants to destroy all evidence of the Holocaust, the camps, the prisoners themselves, the records, the paperwork. And one of the ideas was to then, of course, destroy all the prisoners. However, Heinrich Himmler, who was the head of the SS Gestapo, Heinrich Himmler issues a somewhat countermanding decree. And what he says to concentration camp commandants is, not kill everyone inside, but don't let anyone fall into the hands of the Allies. And he made his wording purposely vague. Why? If Hitler or if anybody realized that he was issuing sort of a countermanding decree, he had plausible deniability. He could say, well, what I meant was kill everyone. Mm-hmm. But in fact, what he was trying to do was he wanted to save tens of thousands of Holocaust survivors so that he could do 2 things with them. One, he could exchange them with Eisenhower in hopes of negotiating a separate surrender, conditional, not unconditional, on the West. That way the Germans could move their troops to the Eastern Front to stop the Russians, the Red Army. The second thing Himmler wanted to do was exchange thousands of concentration camp prisoners for his own life.
So
the plan is that commandants would march thousands and thousands of prisoners north to the Baltic. Now, the north central Germany, the Baltic coast, was about the only place in Germany not overrun by the Allies. There, he could organize thousands and thousands of concentration camp prisoners, and himself, they could board a ship and then go for the exchange or to save his life. And the ship that Himmler and others ordered to be brought to the Baltic coast was, of course, this Cap Arcona, this Nazi Titanic, this famous ship. Mm-hmm. And then the plan was that he would, of course, board the ship and leave with the survivors. But at the end of the war, Hitler kills himself. Goebbels kills himself. Himmler has to take off his uniform, get fake identity papers, and go on the run. Hermann Göring is on the run. So the complete Nazi command was in disarray. It was absolute chaos. So the two Nazi commanders at the Baltic, one was a guy named Count George von Basewitz Baer, a mouthful. He was the head Gestapo official. The other one was a guy who functioned as sort of the mayor or governor, if you will, of Hamburg in the region. His name was Karl Kaufmann. Those two guys developed a diabolical plan. Let's load everyone up on the ship, but then let's sink it. Let's scuttle it. And that way we'll destroy all evidence of the Holocaust. We'll kill all these survivors, but we will deny the Allies from getting their hands on the pride of the Third Reich, our beloved Nazi Titanic. And at the end of World War One, the previous World War, when it was apparent that all was over and the German Navy was being captured and taken to Scapa Flow in Scotland, the Germans, rather than allow the victors to take their ships, what the Germans did was scuttled their own ships. So they planned to scuttle the Nazi Titanic, and that's where the story takes us.
Interesting. And also, I think it's true that the Free French scuttled the French Navy during the war to keep it out of the hands of the Vichy collaborating government. So I guess
sure, they wanted to deny the Vichys,
right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Sure, there's
now,
a lot of precedents.
So you also had the phenomena toward the end of the war of Nazis such as Eichmann and others actually rounding up Jews from concentration camps to sell them for money. I mean, this is what was going on in Hungary at the time. There was actually an agent there from Palestine who was trying to make deals to save Jews by buying them. This is how several people escaped. I'm wondering if that might not have been a part of this. Were the people that were put aboard the Ancona, were they Jewish Holocaust prisoners, or were they American prisoners, POWs? I mean, who were they also?
Good. You raise a good point. First off, yeah, you're absolutely right, and that is there were a whole wide array of responses to the Holocaust in the final days, final weeks of that terrible period in history. Some concentration camp commandants literally just killed everyone in mass acts of murder. Others took their uniforms off, put on civilian clothes, and ran like hell trying to save their own hides. There were efforts to smuggle people out and save people. The French resistance, an underground partisans fighting against the Nazis, were getting involved. So there were a whole wide array. The people put on the ship at the very end, it's hard to get a number because even though the Nazis were meticulous about their record keeping, in the final days, tens of thousands were marched from any camp not overrun to a camp in northern central Germany called Neuengamme. It's near Hamburg. And it's possible that 100,000 survivors were sent there. Then those are sent north to the Baltic, some marched by foot, some in barges towed by tugboats. Others were stuffed into cars on trains, wagons on trains, and taken there. And tens of thousands arrived, but tens of thousands perished. The folks that were put on board the ship were predominantly Jews, but also captured Russian soldiers, suspected Germans of not being loyal to the Nazis. There were something like two dozen nationalities on board the ship, including French and others. The predominant group were Jews from the Nazi seized territories that were put on board the ship. So it was a mix of all sorts of folks. So at the very
anyone
end, you could even
an enemy of the state.
Bingo.
Right. And also, once they were aboard, did they know that, I mean, wasn't there any awareness on the part of these thousands of people that this was what was afoot? I mean, you know, and if so, was there any resistance?
Great question. So what happens is when they all are brought to Neuengamme, some thought they were all just going to be slaughtered there. Others were saying, well, why would they not just kill us at the original camp? So the thought among most of them was they don't want us to be grabbed by the Allies. So they want to keep moving us. Now, during this brutal death march and being taken by trains north to the Baltic, what they saw was the obvious scenes that the war was ending. They heard Allied planes flying over. Allied planes
right.
actually bombed some of the tugboats, some of the ships, some of the folks marching, and there was horrible instances of friendly fire. They also saw that German villages throughout the region were like ghost towns because people had run. So it seems like most folks believe they were being taken to the Baltic. Now, why were they being taken? A lot of them thought they were being taken to the Baltic to avoid falling into the hands of the Allies. The other prevailing view by those that wrote about it, those that survived, was this. There was a Swedish count by the name of Folke Bernadotte, who
right.
was part of the royal family. And Bernadotte was going to camps in the final weeks of the war and trying to rescue as many people as possible. He had cut a deal with Heinrich Himmler. Bernadotte figured correctly that the Nazis would kill everyone in the final days. He also heard a rumor that Himmler was open to negotiate. So he set up a series of a couple of clandestine meetings with Himmler. Folke Bernadotte left a detailed diary and memoir about this, so we know. And what he did was he told Himmler, "I know Eisenhower and I know Montgomery, the American and British leaders. I can therefore be the one who negotiates to save your life." And Bernadotte completely lied. He did not know Eisenhower or Montgomery, but he plays Himmler like a guitar. Himmler takes the bait and releases to him over the course of several meetings, over the course of a few weeks, thousands of survivors, Scandinavians, French, Jews, women from Ravensbrück and elsewhere. So a lot of these survivors had seen Folke Bernadotte show up at the camps with his legendary white buses. He got ambulances and buses painted in white and put the Red Cross on the roof. So Bernadotte was actually at the coast, the Baltic coast, rescuing people from the ship and from the docks at the coast. So a lot of them thought they were going to be put on a ship, taken to Sweden to be rescued by Bernadotte. That's what Bernadotte wanted. But while Bernadotte was negotiating, Adolf Hitler learns that Himmler is cutting a deal. So Hitler sends two assassins to kill Himmler. Himmler then assumes the identity of a police sergeant and changes his name and goes on the run. So Bernadotte is at the Baltic coast as thousands and thousands of prisoners keep arriving every day and keep being jammed aboard, packed aboard this ship, the Nazi Titanic. So Bernadotte has gold, art, treasure. He's bribing the Nazis on the ship and the Nazis at the coast to allow him to take prisoners back. And he actually brought two ships with him, two hospital ships. And he put a group of about 1,600 folks on the ships and was able to rescue them. So a lot of the people at the coast did not resist because they thought that they were being rescued, and especially when they saw Bernadotte.
Right.
Bernadotte rushes back to Scandinavia to take thousands of prisoners with him, vowing that I'll be back as soon as I get more treasure and money to bribe. However, sadly, while Bernadotte was away, before he could make it back, this is when the ship was mistakenly blown up and thousands and thousands and thousands of people perished in the final moments of the war.
Now, when you say the ship was mistakenly blown up, what actually happened? I mean, was it did the Allies mistakenly torpedo it, or was the Nazis themselves blew it up? Was it an accident?
Good, yeah, it was an accident. So the plan was, with Himmler on the run, and then he ultimately gets captured and commits suicide, you have thousands and thousands, we don't even know how many, it's easily tens of thousands of people at the pier, at the port, and thousands on board the Nazi Titanic. Now, with Himmler gone, no one knew what to do. So these two Nazi commanders that I mentioned a moment ago, Karl Kaufmann and this Count von Basewitz-Baer, they say, let's put everybody on board the ship and sink it. But let's sink it as soon as peace is ready to be signed. So it'll be just a horrible, tragic irony and sort of our final way of saying, screw you to the world. So the Nazis planned on scuttling the ship. They even fill it with gasoline to make it burn better, and that the ship's engines were fried, its turbines were fried. It was unseaworthy. It didn't have water, didn't have food. It was undermanned. There wasn't enough crew. So it wasn't sailing anywhere. It was just anchored as a floating dead hawk. But the Nazis filled it with gasoline. Right when the Nazis were ready to scuttle the ship, on May 3rd, 1945, in the final moments of the war, the British overran the coast. It was a special forces unit, the British 6th Commando, came in along with the Scottish 15th, a tank unit, and others. And because the Nazis did not have much in the way of a military there, it wasn't the Wehrmacht, the regular Nazi military. It was what was called the Volkssturm, a couple of older men, some Hitler youth, and a couple of naval cadets. So the British made very quick work of the Nazis before the Nazis could scuttle the ship. As the British were securing the coast and forcing the Nazis and the residents to sign the peace treaty, six squadrons of British bombers, the Royal Air Force, flew in to the coast, and they mistakenly blew up the ship with everybody on board, thinking that it was either, I mean, it didn't look like a warship. It was an ocean liner, but they were thinking that it was being used as a troop transport. And one of the rumors that had been circulating in the final weeks of the war was the Nazis would either go somewhere into Austria or they would escape across the Baltic to Norway and dig in for one final last stand. And,
right,
of course, the geographic isolation of Norway, coupled with the cold weather, the mountains and the fjords, would provide a perfect place for a last redoubt, one last stand. And Allied intelligence did, in fact, observe German U-boat subs heading into the fjords in Norway to hide. So a lot of the Allied intelligence reports and some of the bomber pilots suspected that this massive ocean liner was going to be used to transport German troops to Norway. So they hit it, and they hit it hard, killing thousands and thousands and thousands of Holocaust survivors, innocent people, crammed below decks. Those folks never had a chance, as well as, ironically enough, thousands and thousands on the deck. So one of the criticisms of the British Royal Air Force is you could obviously tell the difference between A, the Nazi Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, shooting back at you, and B, an ocean liner that didn't fire a shot with thousands of skeletal-like people in striped uniforms on board the deck. But yet the British hit it. They hit it hard and killed thousands in what is history's worst example of friendly fire and arguably one of the most tragic maritime disasters in world history.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make that case very well. The is there any evidence that the the pilots that did hit the plane, that they had visual contact with the ship and that they saw what was going on there?
Yes, there was. Count Folke Bernadotte, the Swedish diplomat and head of the Red Cross, the day before the incident occurred, he had taken a large group of folks back to Scandinavia to freedom. He contacted the British Bomber Command and notified them that the ship was being filled with concentration camp prisoners, not German soldiers. Now, the problem is the British command, its bomber command has better intelligence, obviously. You're up in the air, you need to have targeting, and you need intelligence for what you're bombing. Fighter command does not have as good of intel. Fighter command are, you know, younger jocks who go in and they hit it hard. Unfortunately, in a bureaucratic snafu, rather than having bomber command in charge of liberating that part of the Baltic, the British Royal Air Force put fighter command in charge.
Uh-huh.
So Bernadotte contacted bomber command, not fighter command. Now, the handful of survivors from this tragedy, some of them wrote that they could see the pilots whizzing by them in the cockpit because these planes came down low to release 60-pound rockets or to use heavy machine guns to strafe the survivors. So they recall seeing the cockpit, I mean the pilot in the cockpit. The other thing was the pilots also hit – the port, where there were thousands of more people in the port. And surely you could tell the difference between thousands of nearly dead survivors versus, you know, the German air Navy or the German military. One of the pilots that hit the site was a Frenchman named Pierre Klosterman. He was flying with the Free French Forces, and he was assigned to that unit. He, in a memoir, almost indicated that he knew what was happening. He didn't specifically say so, but what he said was a day or two before, he said, "I was flying near Kiel, which is just a bit up the coast, another German city." And he said, "The bomber pilot to the left of me, the bomber pilot to the right of me were blown out of the sky by German anti-aircraft guns and flak." He said that the plane I was flying that day, I hit my plane. It was a Typhoon bomber. He said my Typhoon bomber had a hole in the tail large enough to kick a soccer ball through it. Of course, he said football. We would say soccer ball. And he said we were supposed to be flying 8 planes, but we had so few pilots and planes left, we were flying 6 in our squadron. So what he said was, I came in to the coast, and he said, I went in hard, and I didn't give a damn who was there, what was there. I was going to kill everything I could along the Baltic. And he let loose everything he had in the plane and then flew back. So that was his word. So it makes this whole thing complicated, yeah.
It seems that the Royal Air Force also operated with a rather heavy hand toward the last months of the war. Let's not forget that they were responsible for the Dresden bombing.
Absolutely.
Bomber Harris,
you're right.
Was the British. And I think that the justification for that was a little bit more plausible, in that they felt that they had to do an extreme scorched earth event to really break the will and break the back of the Nazis. Otherwise, they might, as you say, have a redoubt in either Austria or Norway. But at this point, Hitler is already dead at that point.
He was dead four days.
Yeah. So, I mean, the war was clearly over and everyone knew it. Did Admiral Karl Dönitz have anything to do with this at all? Because he was actually Hitler's heir and he headed the government in that region for the next month or so.
I think, yes, correct. And he did, and you're spot on. With everything, you know, Dresden and a scorched earth policy. Even in April, Winston Churchill has this famous decree where he says, maybe we need to pull back in this firebombing of cities and civilian targets. So Churchill even realizes they had maybe gone a little too far. Admiral Karl Dönitz was one of the few top Nazi commanders still functioning. He did have somewhat of a navy. He had several U-boats. He was given command of military personnel to try to make something of this. What he had done is he wanted these ships, like the giant Cap Arcona, this big ocean liner of the Nazi Titanic, he wanted them all under control of the Kriegsmarine. Now, interestingly, the company that owned it, Hamburg South America, or Hamburg Sud, S-U-D, they're still in business, they wanted the ship back. They didn't want all their assets gone for whatever post-war economy might exist. There were the equivalent of merchant marine units that wanted control of the ship. So what you had in the final days was competing layers of Nazi command fighting for control of the ship. And Dönitz wanted control, but he was up to his ears in other matters.
Right.
So he didn't have any direct responsibility. What happened was the shipping company said, we want the ship. We don't want it in forward lines. Leave it at the coast. Leave it anchored so that we can have it after the war. But the two Nazi commanders I mentioned at the coast, they overruled the shipping company and said, we have control of it, and it's going to be used to be scuttled to kill all these survivors. So, you know, as you well know, the last week of the war, if not the last several weeks of the war, were absolute moments of chaos. Red Army was rushing in, as the Americans were rushing toward Berlin, as some German units were surrendering, others were fighting to the very last bitter moment, and the communications were not getting through. And you had thousands and thousands of people sitting, literally, at the coast and just crammed below decks in the ship, dying by day. There was no food, no medicine, no water. And in fact, the Count, the Swedish Count that I've been describing, when he arrived at the coast, Count Bernadotte, he said that he could smell it before he saw it, because what happened was some of the trains that the Nazis brought to the coast, they went to Lübeck Bay near the town of Neustadt, north central Germany. What they did is when the trains arrived with cars filled with Holocaust prisoners, the Nazis, as soon as they stopped the trains, they took off the uniforms, put on civilian clothes, and ran like hell. They never unlocked the cars. So Bernadotte finds hundreds of people dead in all these cars, which was just, you know, unimaginable. And so it was just, it was one of those chaotic moments. So Admiral Dönitz,
you know, and also in,
you know, was a player, but not a major player.
In defense of the British position, I suppose, I mean, on the one hand, the ship was near the port of Kiel, I think, as you say, that being the Cap Arcona. And that was the major German naval port in the Baltic. It was a place of a center of German military power, that the Germans had been firing U-2 rockets at Great Britain right in, up until the last months of the war, and that there were rumors that the Germans were about to launch major high-tech weapons in that region. In fact, Hitler looked at that as his last gasp hope to save Germany was to launch, not nuclear, because he viewed that as a Jewish science, but they had other things. They had the Foo Fighters. They had these, all these other things they were developing.
Yep.
And they were promising to put them online as soon as possible. So the Allies might not have known, or they might have assumed that the ship could have been a part of something like that. You know, they could have been a prep, because they had no way of knowing, or did they know? Well, you do say they did know, but at least in some parts of the bureaucracy,
what happened was
that was going on there.
I think again, you're spot on, Chuck. But what had happened was, Bomber Command was notified. Now, we don't know, and I was not able to find out, we don't know who failed to pass that information along in the line of bureaucracy during those final crazy moments. But, yeah, the ship was not – the Lübeck Bay is not too far from Kiel, and the area in Neustadt where it was, there was a small naval base nearby, and there was a technology center, so there was some high-tech weapons research going on in the area. Moreover, in the days leading up to this, the bombers that were cleaning up everything along the coast, they daily were under fire from German anti-aircraft. The day that they hit and sunk May 3rd at 2:30 p.m., the afternoon that they hit the ship, it was very, very heavy cloud cover. It was raining, and the clouds were so heavy that the bombers had to drop down to a low elevation to come in for their attack. And that low elevation put them at direct risk of anti-aircraft. So knowing that there was a high, seeing a lot of people at the port and knowing that there was a naval base nearby, I'm sure they came down out of the clouds, guns blazing. The other thing, I guess, in defense of the British is that they had lost so many pilots and so many planes. They were not at full strength, as I mentioned a moment ago. And a lot of these pilots were 20 years old. They were brand new pilots being rushed through training, shoved into a cockpit. And the planes that they were flying, these Typhoons, these are not giant bombers like a Lancaster or our B-17 or B-24, but they're not small, maneuverable fighters that can do pinpoint accuracy like the British Spitfire or our Mustang. It's sort of a hybrid plane. A Typhoon is a little bigger than a fighter, a little smaller than a bomber. So some of these guys were not they had been taken planes.
Sorry to interrupt, but we've reached toward the end of the program. Briefly, the book is The Nazi Titanic, available in all major bookstores, available at Barnes & Noble. Robert Watson, great conversation. I want to thank you for joining me. I'd like to do another program soon, maybe on others of your books and articles. Thank you so much, Robert.
It was my pleasure. I'd love to do it again. Thank you, Chuck.
All right. Take care. All right, so that wraps things up today on Chuck Moore Speaks. Of course, you can check out my books. They're available at Amazon.com. Not to get in a plug there, but so be it. And thanks, everyone, for joining me. Talk to you soon.